So, you know Europe, right? It's rainy and it has mimes. That place. You're probably pretty familiar with it. What happens if you go east from it? Well, if you go east through the countries you know, France, Hungary, the Duchy of Venice, the Holy Roman Empire, the first place you get to that's only arguably part of Europe is the Byzantine Empire. See? I pronounced it right this time. Don't tell me if they're still around. I know they've been having some trouble lately, and I'm not totally caught up on what's been happening with the Byzantines, but, you know, I've been working on Tor's Cabinet so long that I haven't caught up on the last few seasons of Europe, and I don't want spoilers, but I'm pretty sure the Byzantines are still there. You get even further east from there, and then you're really somewhere else. Out there, people are Muslim. You know about Muslims, at least a little bit. I think they worship a god called Termagant. They got minarets and stuff. Some of them wear turbans, I think. They're not Christians, we can be sure of that, but, you know, they're people. You know, they got all the same normal lives we do. You go even further east, though, that gets less clear. There's some place out there called India, where spices came from. Alexander the Great went there once, a long time ago, and since we have all kinds of accurate historical accounts of Alexander the Great, we know a fair amount about what you encounter on the road to India. Somewhere around there, maybe in India, maybe somewhere north of there, or maybe somewhere even further east, you get to a place where people have dog heads. Cynocephaly is the official medical term. It means dog-headedness. They, too, are people. They're well-documented as having clothes and houses and plowing their fields just like us. Most of the top monks who have been consulted on this question believe dog-headed people have souls and are worth considering as humans. Then you encounter the Blemmies. This is a Blemmie. They have these somewhere around India, too. Out where, like, the Silk Road goes. As you can see, he's a dude with no head and a face on his chest. I don't think Blemmies often wear clothes. Like, you know, they probably wouldn't wear shirts, no matter what, but they could at least put some pants on. The fact that they don't suggests that they're not as human as the dog people. There's less theological debate about whether Blemmies have souls. Most people agree they don't. Also, in this area, there are fearsome cinnamon birds. That's where cinnamon comes from. Actually, there's a whole other place called Cinnamon Land, which only the cinnamon birds can fly to, but they gather cinnamon sticks from there. I don't think anyone knows where cinnamon sticks first come from, but the cinnamon birds, they fly to Cinnamon Land, they get cinnamon sticks, and then they fly back to India, and they use those to build their nests. These birds are huge, they're bigger than horses. They nest up on cliff ledges. The brave cinnamon merchants, then, they have to bait the cinnamon birds by leaving a dead ox at the bottom of the cliff. So the birds swoop down, they're like, score, fresh meat, and they carry the ox up to their nest, because not even a cinnamon bird can eat a whole ox in one go, and then the weight of the ox makes the nests collapse, and the cinnamon merchants gather all the cinnamon sticks that come tumbling down the cliff. It's dangerous work. That's why cinnamon is so expensive. We're so glad that the cinnamon merchants told us about those birds they have to fight, or else we'd question why they have to charge such high prices, and maybe we'd decide to find a way to get our own cinnamon. But after you've passed by all these things, finally you get to a place that's actually, not that weird. Sitting there incongruously amid all the exotic creatures and cultures of Asia is a wise Christian king, Prester John. How'd he get there? I'm ye olde host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian. And this is Thimble the Doll. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities.
Then leave your
Everything I just described consists of real medieval legends about Asia, widely believed across Europe from about 1200 AD to the Renaissance, and surviving as common knowledge in stories that everyone knew were fictional by that point, all the way up to the 18th century. Prester John was a common character in these stories, portrayed pretty consistently, more consistently than most features of the mythical Orient, as the leader of a wise and prosperous Christian kingdom. The fact that he was Christian was the most important part. It wasn't clear to medieval Europeans if there were Christians out there. Many suspected there weren't, but it was reassuring to believe that over on the other side of the Muslim caliphates, Europe's great enemy at the time, over on the other side of all the weirdness of Central Asia, someone, somewhere, was a Christian. Perhaps an exotic sect of Christianity, and perhaps his land was just as strange in culture as the dog people were strange in physiology, but Prester John's country was rich, and it was Christian, not Muslim. Far away, there was another light of the civilized Christian world. The first known account of Prester John situates him in a very specific place. It was the year 1145. The Crusades were underway, uniting almost all of Western Europe across ethnicities and social classes in an effort to take back the Holy Land from Muslims. As you probably know, there were several Crusades, some of which almost didn't fail. The first Crusade was the one that most clearly didn't fail. In 1099, still in living memory by the time Prester John became a thing, the Crusaders had successfully taken Jerusalem, but their grip was slipping by the mid-12th century. In 1144, Edessa, in modern-day Turkey, the first Christian state established in the Middle East by the Crusaders, fell to the Muslims. Jerusalem could be next. Fortunately, though, the next year, news broke that a Christian king nobody had ever heard of from unexplored lands far to the east was causing a new headache for the Muslims. The story went that out in Persia, modern-day Iran, a land at least known about, if not well mapped, by Europeans, a Christian king named John, commanding vast armies, had just defeated the Persians in a brutal 3-day battle. He was now charging toward the Holy Land to join in the Crusades. Of course he wanted to join the Crusades, he was Christian. But he was held back by the Tigris River in present-day Iraq. While John was a Christian, he was a Nestorian Christian, considered a heresy by the Catholic Church. Nestorianism in the early days of Christianity was a non-Trinitarian Christian belief common to a bunch of different sects that held that Jesus consisted of two separate entities, one human, one divine. Gradually to the West, Nestorian came to be an umbrella term for Christians in the Middle East with unusual and non-standard to them beliefs. Calling Prester John a Nestorian meant he wasn't a Catholic, but probably didn't mean to insinuate anything more specific about his beliefs. But in a surprisingly pragmatic turn, most people in Europe hearing about Prester John were relieved and saw him as a potential ally. Theological quibbles be damned. At least he wasn't a Muslim. Don't compare him to the Almighty, compare him to the alternative. The name, Prester John, Prester being a word for a priest who serves in a powerful secular office as well, which pretty much only survives as a word at all in the name of Prester John, that title was first used in 1165 in a letter purportedly coming from Prester John presented to Pope Alexander III. This letter went the medieval equivalent of viral, and it was easy to see why. In the letter, Prester John described himself as a king of, quote, the three Indias, going on to describe his kingdom in detail. Every kind of exotic and mythical creature lives there, from tigers and polar bears to satyrs, phoenixes, and cyclops, which were all in roughly the same category of creature to 12th century Europeans. There was a fountain of youth, a gem that cured blindness, and an herb that could permanently protect you from demons. There was a landscape of ever-shifting, uncrossable sand dunes, which is one of the things mixed into the fantasy that must have been taken from real travelers' accounts of Central Asia. The 10 lost tribes of Israel lived in Prester John's India, too. The Garden of Eden is nearby, although it's not a paradise anymore, just an interesting historical site. There were aquatic children and fish with purple blood that they made into dye, which, considering how rare purple pigments were, has the same vibes as claiming the streets were paved with gold. Also, the streets were literally paved with gold. Women and men lived separately, not just in separate rooms, but in separate cities, except on a holiday 4 times a year where the women come to the men's cities to get pregnant. Prester John claimed his father was named Quasideus, meaning almost a god, and Quasideus had received a vision from God telling him how to build the world's coolest temple. About a quarter of the letter was devoted to details about all the gemstones and precious metals that were used to build the temple. It's still not known who wrote this letter. It draws off some existing legends about majestic kingdoms in the Far East, probably garbled stories about China, and makes up a lot of details too. It's not clear if Pope Alexander read the letter at all, nor how much of it he believed. But I think from the response letter the Pope wrote, we can guess that he believed Prester John was real, but a wild exaggerator. Maybe he existed, and maybe he ruled over a prosperous Christian kingdom, but not as prosperous as the bizarre utopia described in the letter. Maybe the satyrs, and purple-blooded fish, and human children going through an aquatic phase were real. The world is a big place, and there are dog-headed people after all. But Prester John also wrote that his subjects never lie and never commit adultery, and I think the Pope was too smart to believe that was possible. So, in 1177, after the Prester John letter had become common knowledge to everyone who could read, the Pope sent his response. The response could be summarized, "I'm a humble servant of God, and you should be too. I don't brag about how rich my kingdom is. Nice to learn you're a Christian, though. Want to team up and do some crusades?" He gave the letter to his doctor, Philip. Sort of an odd person to delegate the task to, but alright. And Philip sailed off from Venice to an unclear destination in the Middle East, after which he presumably headed out into the desert in search of Prester John and died. Prester John legends died down for about a half century after that, until 1221, when the Fifth Crusade was drawing to a bloody close with a near-complete European defeat. By then, the Crusades were failing. Jerusalem had been lost long ago. Europe was beginning to get sick of interminable, increasingly long-shot attempts to recapture it. But now, once again, surprise, surprise, Prester John was coming to help. Wait, 80 years after his existence was first reported? Well, the letter to Pope Alexander did mention a fountain of youth in Prester John's land, but when you create overpowered magic in your story, you have to find some way to restrict it, and I guess they did that with Prester John's fountain. Few sources from the time of the Fifth Crusade try to claim that it's the same Prester John who's coming to save the Crusaders. Instead, this guy was usually called King David, and said to be the son, grandson, or great-grandson of the original Prester John, who wrote the Pope Alexander letter. Some sources refer to him as Prester John, and then specify that that's a title used by King David, a descendant of the original Prester John. But either way, once again, Europe was being served very detailed dispatches of King David's approach. He'd already conquered Merv, Bukhara, and Khorasan, all cities on the Silk Road in Central Asia, loosely known to Europeans. He was advancing toward Baghdad. Many merchants fled into the Middle East from countries further east with precise and consistent descriptions of King David's conquests. He was brutal, but the people he was brutalizing were Muslim. Clearly, then, he had to be a good Christian, coming to save them. The Europeans pulled back from their battle lines, confident that relief was at last on its way. Within a month of the first King David rumors spreading, the Crusaders were conclusively defeated by the Muslims in the Battle of Mansura, and the Fifth Crusade was over. Prester John may have failed to show, but the stories about him were consistent enough that they had to be talking about someone specific. Even the doubters were convinced. Purple-blooded fish, maybe not, but Prester John, sure, he was a mainstay in pop culture from then on. Descriptions of him and his kingdom became more abstract. As trade links with the Far East improved and no majestic Christian kingdom was found to exist, by the 15th century, Prester John's supposed homeland was moved south, to Ethiopia. Now, Ethiopia was a Christian kingdom at this point, a fairly powerful and developed one with trade ties to Europe, though few Europeans had ever been there. A prosperous Christian empire on the edges of the known world that you have to go through Muslim territory and blistering deserts to get to did exist all along, and learned people knew it. It was Ethiopia. So naturally, before long, Europe came to believe that Prester John was Ethiopian. For centuries, it was an open question whether the land of Prester John was just Ethiopia, or if there was a different Christian kingdom in Africa, home to Prester John. Fascinatingly, in the 1420s, the royal family of Aragon in modern-day Spain considered marrying into the royal family of Ethiopia. The concept of race didn't really exist yet. Ethiopia was powerful and Christian and worth allying with, especially if it was also the same place Prester John ruled. The Aragonese crown sent emissaries to Ethiopia to ask about Prester John. They'd never heard of him. The marriage was called off. Gradually, Europe began to establish more organized trade links and eventually colonies in Africa. When Portugal set up full diplomatic relations with Ethiopia in 1520, the name they referred to the existing Ethiopian emperor, Lebna Dengal, as was Prester John. It continued to be unclear whether Prester John was Ethiopian or not. Half of Europe insisted Prester John was just another title for the royal family of Ethiopia. The other half penetrated further into Africa with the intention of finding the real Prester John. That was one of the justifications for a lot of early colonial missions. It wasn't until the 1700s, long before the conquest of Africa had really heated up, when Europe finally gave up searching, and the remaining pop culture footprint of Prester John is scattered between the more recent claims he lived in Africa and the original claims he lived in Asia. John Buchan, who was the author of The 39 Steps and also Governor General of Canada, did you know that part, wrote a novel in 1910 about a South African anti-colonial leader who calls himself Prester John. But there's also a minor Marvel supervillain named Prester John, who is an immortal alchemist king from Central Asia. Also, you know what? The way I've told it so far, Prester John seems to be the ghost of Kiev of the medieval Crusades, a mythical hero created to boost wartime morale. And that's probably why the stories of his kingdom initially caught on. Later, when Prester John didn't come to save the Crusades, believing in Prester John, either in Asia or Africa, became a bit like believing in UFOs. Before the world was mapped, it was comforting for Christian Europeans to believe they weren't alone in the universe. But the initial story of Prester John in 1145 was too precise to not refer to something. The Persians must have just lost a defining battle to someone. Who? Well, first thing to understand, when the medieval Europeans talked about Persians, who they meant were these people. It's the Seljuk Turks. The Seljuk Empire was not in great shape around this time either. You may think, well, didn't they win the Crusades against the Christians? No, not the Seljuks. The only direct conflict between Seljuks and Crusaders was in the First Crusade, which the Christians won. That was the last time the Seljuks had a foothold in the Levant. All the later Crusades were beaten back by other Muslim empires, mostly from today's Egypt. And not long after the Seljuks lost the Levant in the First Crusade, they lost a substantial chunk of the eastern part of their empire, too, to an empire you may not have ever heard of, the Karatitai. They were an ethnically Mongolian people, originally nomads, who had swept into China in the 900s, taken over, and established the Liao dynasty, which ruled over the northern half of China for about 200 years. Cathay, the old European word for China, comes from the Titai. The Titai became culturally Chinese, and their elite began speaking Chinese, but the rise of the Jin dynasty in China forced the Titai west to modern-day Xinjiang and the Central Asian Stan countries, where they attempted to expand their empire further west. In 1141, outside the Silk Road city of Samarkand in modern-day Uzbekistan, they routed the Seljuks. Muslim sources claim the Titai had an army of 300,000 or more, though this was probably exaggerated to make the Seljuks' defeat seem less embarrassing and more of an inevitability. The Seljuk Empire began to crumble after this. Most of Central Asia became semi-independent vassal states of the Karatitai, and news of this massive defeat for the Muslims reached Europe. Through a medieval game of telephone, the conquests of these Chinese-looking and Chinese-speaking people in Central Asia became a Christian empire, coming to save the Crusades. Seemingly, the Europeans thought that if the Titai weren't Muslim, they had to be Christian. But they weren't, right? They were Buddhists. Or were they? Okay, remember how the earliest sources said Prester John was a Nestorian Christian, which roughly meant any ancient Christian churches in the East that aren't Catholic? Well, there were Nestorian Christians in the Karatitai. There's a surprisingly long history of Christianity in China. It was at the end of the Silk Road, after all. Ideas made their way from the Middle East to China pretty quickly. In Xi'an, home of the Terracotta Warriors, you can see a carved monument from 781 AD documenting the history of Eastern, Nestorian, if you will, Christianity in China. They call it the Shining Religion of the Romans and mention that Christians, while always a minority in China, weren't persecuted at all at that point, and there were high-ranking Christians in the imperial military. The carved message is signed in Hebrew by its author, a monk named Adam. Not much later, in 845, though, Christianity was banned by the Tang Dynasty, along with Buddhism, which was also new in China at that point. and Christians fled out into Central Asia. But when the Kharatitai took over that area, although the Titai were Buddhist, the Christians weren't oppressed and probably did sometimes serve in major roles under the Titai. It was known to Europeans at the time that there were Christians out in Central Asia, just that their beliefs were slightly different from the ones promoted by the Catholic Church. How different? Well, they have a Nestorian two-part view of the divinity of Christ, we know that, and maybe they call him something else, like Buddha, maybe. But ultimately they're Christians. We'll take what we can get out in the barbarian wilderness. Of course, less than a century after the Kharatitai beat the Seljuks, in the 1200s a different group of former Mongolian nomads were ripping through Central Asia, Genghis Khan and his troops. Often you'll hear claims today that Prester John was a misinterpretation of Genghis Khan, and one incarnation of Prester John definitely was. King David, who everyone thought was about to save the Europeans during the Fifth Crusade. At the time of the Fifth Crusade, Genghis Khan had conquered Merv, Bukhara, and Khorasan, and was advancing toward the Near East. The Mongols under Genghis Khan were Tengrists, the traditional Mongol shamanic religion in which Genghis Khan became the main incarnation of God after he died, because he just wasn't done going hard after he died. It's one thing to be deified, it's another to become the god of the already existing religion you practice. There are still Tengrists today. These days it's mostly a religion of Genghis Khan worship. I went to an Aobao, one of the Tengrists' open-air temples, when I went to Baotou in Inner Mongolia, which is part of China but culturally a Mongolian, a few years ago. But there were reasons why medieval Europeans thought Genghis Khan had to be Christian. It wasn't just that he wasn't Muslim. They knew there were more than two religions in the world, but Europeans knew there really were Christians in Central Asia, and whoever was conquering the edges of the known world, he seemed to be fine with Christians at least. During the Siege of Baghdad in 1258, the Mongols killed all the Muslims, but spared the Christians. Genghis was no zealot, he was a pragmatist. The other religions in his milieu were Buddhism and Islam. Buddhism promoted vegetarianism, Islam banned alcohol. The Mongols loved meat and alcohol, and Christianity let them have both. Several of Genghis Khan's sons were married to Christian princesses, and some of them took up Christianity themselves. Not long after the Fifth Crusade, Europeans became aware that the Mongols were not Christians, but that didn't stop them from hoping the Khans would swoop in and save the Crusades. There were attempts at a Franco-Mongol alliance in the late 13th century. The Crusaders, who called themselves Franks, although they were from all across Europe, regularly sent letters to the Mongols trying to establish an alliance. These messages regularly urged them to convert to Catholicism as well, assuming that the Mongols were so religiously tolerant and, well, the Catholics have the world's one true religion, so that probably wasn't too much of an ask, right? Then the Mongol response was always basically, "Hey, yeah, thanks for being interested in an alliance, but we Mongols don't do alliances. We have vassals and we have enemies. Kneel down and accept us as masters of the universe, and we won't kill you all. Thanks." But there was almost a successful Crusader-Mongol alliance during the Seventh Crusade, in which Goyuk, the grandson of Genghis Khan and emperor of the Mongols at the time, sent two Nestorian Christian Mongol envoys to King Louis IX of France, suggesting the Mongols take Baghdad to divide the Muslims' attention while the Crusaders invade Egypt. Louis approved of this plan, but Goyuk died and was replaced by his wife, who was far less interested in holding up the Mongol side of the bargain, before the French ambassadors giving him the green light could get to Mongolia. The French were routed in Egypt, and King Louis himself was captured for ransom. From then on, the Mongols were less popular in Europe. And Prester John stuck around in stories, this time as an enemy of the Mongols. Nobody looked back on the King David rumors and went, "Oh, that must have been Genghis Khan everyone was talking about." Before Prester John's homeland got moved to Africa, but after Europe understood the Mongols weren't their friends, there was an era of Prester John stories in which either the Mongols defeated Prester John, indicating that he was no longer being seen as the invincible god king of a Christian utopia, or Prester John was indeed a Christian king in Asia, but ruling over some dusty, unremarkable country on the edges of the Mongol Empire. Marco Polo, who traveled to China from 1271 to 1295, writes with apparent certainty that he traveled through the former land of Prester John, though he seemed to be interested in bursting Europeans' bubbles and crushing their utopian dreams about Prester John. This is a theme in Marco Polo's writing. He writes that all the mythical things Europeans think exist in Central Asia do exist, but they're not that cool. Unicorns? Marco Polo saw some unicorns. They're, quote, "really ugly brutes." They were actually rhinos. On Prester John, Marco Polo says that back when Genghis Khan's empire was small and he was just a regional warlord, the Khan asked for Prester John's daughter's hand in marriage. The Prester refused to marry his daughter to such a lowly barbarian, to which Genghis responded by going to war and destroying Prester John's kingdom, one of the first of his many conquests. This really happened. Like the later identification of Prester John with the Emperor of Ethiopia, here Marco Polo was taking a real person and calling him Prester John. The Christian king in the Far East who made Marco Polo go, "Oh yeah, we know that guy, we call him Prester John," was Togrul, the king of the Karaites. The Karaites are not to be confused with the Karaites, a sect of Judaism. The Karaites were sort of the closest real thing to the original story of Prester John. They were a Nestorian Christian empire far, far out in Asia, incorporating parts of modern-day Russia, Mongolia, and China. They had converted around 1000 AD, allegedly after the Karaite Khan got lost in a snowstorm and had a vision of Saint Sergius of Samarkand showing him the way home. And although they were in full communion with the semi-organized Church of the East, Karaite Christianity was very much its own thing, with influences from Mongol shamanism and traditional Chinese religion. The Belgian missionary William of Rubruck, who underwent a similar journey to Marco Polo a generation before, spent some time with the Karaites and barely considered them Christians. Still, did you know that there was a medieval, officially Christian empire that included parts of present-day Northeast China? I didn't until recently. I've been to territory that used to belong to the Karaite Empire, and they sure don't talk about it. So around 1200 AD, the Khan of the Karaites was this guy, Togrul. Togrul had consolidated his authority over the Mongol tribes after some of them sided with challenges to his leadership. There was a brief period when Togrul's uncle overthrew him and forced him to flee into the steppe. Togrul returned to power with the help of a chief named Yesuge, who had a son named Temujin. You know that name, don't you? Temujin, skilled and charismatic, began undertaking more and more ambitious regional conquests for Togrul. Togrul would say, "Go out and conquer those people," and Temujin would do it. Temujin gained so much power that people stopped listening to Togrul. Temujin began raising armies that were loyal to him, not Togrul. And eventually, Temujin demanded to marry his son to Togrul's daughter. Togrul saw this as what it was, an attempt to take full control of the Karaite kingdom. He refused. Temujin turned on his old mentor and destroyed the Karaites. After taking care of the last few tribes who challenged his rule, Temujin took on a new name, of which the meaning is still unclear today. Genghis Khan. So, in a way, Prester John was less of a mythical figure and more of a garbled European nickname for a series of real people. European Christendom wanted to believe that they weren't alone in the universe, that somewhere out there existed others who kept the flame of faith alive. And they were not wrong. There were other Christians, far beyond the borders Europeans had mapped. It was only in the late Middle Ages that Christianity became a mostly European religion rather than a mostly Asian one. There were Christian missionaries in China before there were Buddhist missionaries in China. There were Christian missionaries in China before there were Christian missionaries in Britain or Scandinavia. I think we underrate just how connected the ancient world was. I mentioned how hard it was to get purple dye in pre-modern times. Do you know where the purple dye Roman senators used to dye their togas came from? Guangdong. The popular image of the Buddha, this one, is inspired by ancient Greek statues, which were brought to India by Alexander the Great's conquests. In fact, thousands of years ago, the main language spoken in the Kashmir Valley was Greek. The Eastern Mediterranean culture that Europeans saw as the height of civilization, everything from Greek philosophy to Christianity, spread much further than medieval Europe knew. But where did the blemmies come from? Blemmies appear in both European and Chinese folklore. Both situate them in Central Asia, around the edge of the known world to them. Why did anyone think these guys existed? We've searched for Prester John. We know the story on Prester John. We understand why people believed in Prester John. Has anyone searched for the blemmies? Be right back. I'm getting myself a plane ticket to Uzbekistan, and I'ma bag myself some blemmies.
something right, but you do something wrong. A little question will break your bones, what puts you on your knees. You paint the walls in red, the color of your heart, but the man in gray will get you now. You've got to hide or take the blame. Want to reach your friends, but they're brave.